I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Monday is the first day of class for students in the Kansas City Public School System. It's also the first school year for the new members of the district's board of directors. Today, two freshmen and the board chair are here to discuss what they see as priorities for students and the district. Is full accreditation the top goal, or is it eliminating duplicated services with the charters? Or will they focus on reducing the frequency of kids changing schools? Then, as a jazz lover, I think it's great when Kansas City recognizes one of its own. This month, it's a celebration of all things Charlie Parker. Find out what's on tap for Bird's birthday as we get you up to date after this hour's news. The Kansas City, Missouri School Board has seven members, and five of them are newcomers who were elected in April. That's a tricky proposition, of course, with the district on the brink of earning full state accreditation. At the same time, charter schools continue to siphon students away, and district school and charters have locked horns when it comes to how education dollars are divided between them. So how is the new board faring? We'll talk to two new members this morning and one veteran to find out. The veteran is Patty Manser. She's a member at large and the board chairwoman. Patty, nice to have you again. Welcome.
Good morning, Steve.
Marvia Jones is here. She's the sub-district 4 board member. She's one of the newbies. Marvia, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you.
Manny Abarca is the sub-district 3 board member. Manny, good morning to you.
Thanks for having me.
You know, Madam Chairwoman, you've got pretty close to a brand new board at what obviously is a crucial time. I can't help but wonder, how's it going?
It's going great. Yeah. And I'm looking at my colleagues as I say that. You know, this election, we brought in people who've got extensive community background in public health, community organizing, business technology, and philanthropy. So the mix of skills on this board is quite amazing right now. Yeah. I think this board is one of the strongest we've seen.
Huh. You know, when you get this many new members at once, does that slow progress on initiatives that were sort of in the hopper before the election? Because, you know, new members take time to get up to speed, as they would anywhere. Yeah.
So, you know, every school board that had elections in April is orienting new members. And we've been doing that. It takes time. It's a process. There's a lot to learn. It's unbelievable how much there is to learn to do this job well. But we have committed to a schedule to do that, and we're sticking with it.
Manny, what's the learning curve been like for you?
Well, so I think within the first few months, we started talking budgeting immediately, right? So We're a little over a quarter of $1 million in the total budget. And as brand new members who are, you know, have all these organic ideas that we talk about politically, it's kind of sobering to see the reality within the budgeting process, right? These are where we're going to dictate the real responsible priorities that we set for the district. So
numbers go a lot to indicate what you can do and what you can't do, is what you're saying. Marvia, how's it going for you?
It's been going well. I think I would echo what Manny said about some sobering realizations about the, budgetary and, you know, things like that. But I have definitely appreciated and been it's been very helpful to have Patty and Jennifer who can sort of guide us along.
The two veteran board members. So when it comes to tight budgets, you run for office, you want to make some change. Is there an initiative or two, Marvia, that you'd like to see get done? And you're sitting here thinking, man, I'm not sure we're going to have the money to get to do it.
Interestingly, most of the things that are near and dear to my heart are not necessarily new things that require a lot of funding. I'm more so concerned about social-emotional development of youth inside of school. So some of these are more so practice changes in at the organizational level. Mm-hmm. I'm also interested in things like how do we continue the improvement we've been seeing with suspensions and how that's handled so that we can reduce the impact to those families and the community at large.
We've talked about suspensions on this show before and the problem with suspensions and the disruption to a young person's education. Are those trends going in the right direction as far as you're concerned right now?
Yes, they are. I mean,
because you want kids in school. That's the whole idea here.
Absolutely. You want them in school. You don't want them susceptible to other things that could harm them while they're not in school. So, yeah, I think from what I've seen from the data, the trends are going in the right direction. There's always some fine tuning and tweaking that could occur. But I think the district is going in the right direction.
Manny, how about you? Is there something, two or three things you want to get done and you're sitting here thinking, are we going to have the money for it?
Well, I think rationally, I came from a situation where I served on a charter school before. So I knew that some of the things that one would go out and say, you know, I want a Hawaiian punch in the water fountain or something like that, they're just not realistic. And so it's more about trying to figure out within the context of what's going on, how you can fit your ideas into those programs that are already in existence.
You know, what would surprise the two of you about serving on the board so far? I mean, was there a stark realization or two that you know, a month in, you're thinking, what have I gotten myself into here, Marvia, or not really?
It would go back to the system analysis that's been shared quite a bit. So I had been hearing bits and pieces of that before.
What are you talking about? That's a big bureaucratic term. What
does
that mean?
Yeah. So just the study that the district has done over the past couple of years that really shows what the educational scene looks like in Kansas City and just seeing how really strapped we all are, the system is, when it comes to the number of students we have, the number of seats, and then how we're inefficiently sharing those resources. So that's been the most startling aspect for me.
Didn't that report also talk about how segregated the community remains when it comes to its educational system? It was pretty eye-opening report. Manny, how about you? What surprised you?
I think realistically, I serve as a treasurer, so I get an opportunity to go to an extra meeting every other week. But
good
I also
for you.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I get the opportunity to work directly with Dr. Bedell's staff, and it is incredible to understand the caliber of leadership that he has around the table, executing the day-to-day operations of the entire district. I think it's very easy to sit outside of the district and look and complain, but when you see the individuals and their skill sets that they're bringing to the table, it's just an astounding team that he's put together.
Just before we move on, why did you run? What was it about this job that drew your attention and your energy to the extent that it has?
Sure. I think initially my board service started elsewhere, right? And at the time, a mentor had approached me and said, hey, you should serve on a school board. And I said, Gilbert, I have no educational background. Like, I'm in governance. I do some other elements. He goes, that's exactly what we need. We don't want you in a classroom teaching anyone. We want you to oversee what's going on and making sure that each and every bit of pieces that are put together are effective for all of our members of our community.
You think that was good advice based on what you know now?
Absolutely. I told him that if that wasn't what it was going to be, then I was going to leave that board, and I'm still serving in some capacity.
Yeah. Marvia, how about you? Why did you run?
Yeah. So other than my own children in the district, and we are and continue to be, we've always been avid supporters of public education, especially urban core education. And as, you know, sort of marrying that experience at the family level and school level with my professional experience, which is in public health and sort of taking a systems approach to how things work, I understood that what goes on at the policy level is so important to the experience that kids and families have on the ground. So
yeah.
I was just really honored to pursue that opportunity.
You know, Patty Manser, I think when people hear that you are the chairwoman of the board of the Kansas City, Missouri School District, the first question that probably comes down the pike, and you get it probably six times a day, full accreditation. When's it going to happen? How confident are you that it's going to happen? What are the latest tea leaves telling you about when that moment might be in the offing?
Well, I think you know that we have been on this journey for a few years, and we're making progress. I mean, we have met the threshold two different years where we've exceeded the 70% that is required. Last year, we were at 82.9%. That means we had 99.5 out of 120 possible points. We think we've got all the right things in place to get there. I mean, we absolutely believe it. Over the last 2 years, we've invested in teacher training. We have revamped the curriculum. We have done deep training and professional readiness for our principals. So we feel like the framework is there to get us there. We're hoping that we might see that this coming year.
I was going to say the timetable would be springtime, Patty.
Potentially. It depends on when the state releases the data.
Mm-hmm.
Some of that information is kind of trickling out to the administration in small components. The full public release may happen later this fall. You might remember this this past year, last year's data was released in February of this year.
Right.
So we're thinking it'll be on an earlier time frame.
And this is, and these numbers are based on tests that the students took when this spring. I need to get my head around this again. Yeah.
So all students do their testing in the spring.
Okay.
And this is for several of the elementary grades and then some of the high school courses. And it's, the accreditation is not only that, it's how we're doing with attendance, how we're doing with graduation,
right,
graduation rates, how we're doing with college and career readiness standards. So there are a mix of stats that go into play that determine if we achieve accreditation.
Okay, so the tests have already been taken. We're waiting for the results. And there's been some criticism of the state in the past for taking so long to get these tests graded and the results out. And you're hoping it's going to be a little faster this year, it sounds
like.
We
think it will be a little bit faster. That's the indication. And we're feeling good. We feel like the investments we put in place and the work that's been done is really laying the groundwork. We think it's yielding results.
You know, Manny, this strikes me, you almost can't emphasize enough what a moment this would be for the district. And I'm wondering if you can sort of conceptualize that for us. How big of a deal would it be for this district to finally regain full accreditation?
Yeah, I think Patty said it best yesterday at Convocation. And so Convocation is where we gather all of the faculty and staff for the entire district, and we get together and we celebrate the beginning of school starting. And Patty said that she can't wait to see a ticker tape parade downtown similar to the World Series, because it's been so long since the district has had full accreditation.
And, you know, in theory, that's exactly what should happen, right?
I mean,
that's what we're talking about
here,
right? That's a victory for the entire city in so many ways, and we can talk more about that. Marvia, how big of a deal would it be? You're nodding your head here as we talk.
Yeah, I think it will be a big deal, and it'll go a long way in restoring some of the confidence that might have been lost in the district for so long. So we're talking people who graduated one to two generations ago who walked across the stage without an accredited diploma. And so I think this will be just something that says, hey, you know, they're turning things around. My children are, you know, are going to fare well there, and we should definitely support, we hope, recapture some support that has been lost over the years.
You know, I was going to ask you, Patty, which of the metrics make you you're most nervous about? I just want to point to one that you already mentioned, which is attendance.
Yes.
You know, a lot of folks, embodied in the whole attendance metric is a lot of the challenges that an inner city school district faces that maybe suburban districts don't. You know, you come from a poverty-stricken family, different challenges within that family, and showing up for school some days, you know, it doesn't happen maybe with the frequency as it would elsewhere. And that metric has been something the district has really focused on the last few years, because you've got to be at 90%, I think, or something like that.
Yes. Yeah. And we have to be 90% of the time over, it's a 90-90 measure over the 90% of the day. The thing about attendance is this is where we need our community and our families.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to step up and help us. We had Summerfest last Saturday. We had about 7,000 people there. Everyone I encountered, and I think my colleagues did the same thing, we said, hey, school starts on Monday, August 12th. Like, we need you here, and come on time.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where we have to put a call out to the community to really commit to that. I think sometimes a parent might think, well, my child's sleepy, or they didn't get a good night's rest. I'm going to just let them sleep in an hour or go in a little bit later. Not only does the child lose ground, but we lose ground, and we actually lose money as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that is an important component, and it's one good way that the community can participate.
Yeah. You know, another change for the district, Manny, compared to recent years, is the stability in the superintendent's office. Mark Bedell just signed another 3-year contract in April. The significance of that is what?
It's major, and it's instrumental to our success. It's having the stability within the top leader there is what makes sure that the rest of the organization's structure is intact. And I think, Patty, you know, you said it best about the attendance component, right? And we realized, too, some of the challenges that we've faced, and we made changes already, right? Our bus contract that we just changed the previous board that Patty served on, and in fact bought our own fleet and switched vendors. And so we're realizing not only the responsibility for our community members, but also on us. And so the leadership from Dr. Bedell, right, coming out the first day last year and saying, hey, my students missed the bus. So we realized this not just affecting our families, but also affecting the district directly.
And again, you know, Marvia, anyone who knows the history here knows there has not been stability in that superintendent's office for a very long time. This is another new chapter here for the district.
Absolutely. And you hear the impact from staff. I've heard it from just in passing, talking to teachers, as well as people in the community who say, oh, you know, we are used to people leaving every 2 to 3 years. And so the problem was things with initiatives would take hold, but they wouldn't stick because people were just waiting for that person to leave. Okay, this will change. But I think Dr. Riddell has absolutely instilled more confidence inside and out of the district by his stability there.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking with members of the Kansas City, Missouri School Board, two new members, a veteran and Patty Manser, who wants to get in this conversation again. Go ahead, Patty.
Well, I wanted to tell you, too, that, and I think you know this, housing instability is really a big issue. That's a big factor. So we can focus on what happens inside the schools.
Affordable housing is another way to put it.
Affordable housing. But we don't have control about what happens in neighborhoods and housing and tenants' rights and those kinds of things. We're hopeful that this is a place where the new mayor and the new city council can play a role. But we are offering a new service. It started about a year ago. We have a partnership with Legal Aid, and they are located within Central High School. And parents can come and get free legal advice on issues that may pertain to housing, renting concerns, tenant issues, or other kinds of legal issues.
You know, Patty, speaking of instability, Jackson County is struggling with property valuations right now throughout the county. There have been thousands of appeals, lots of delays here. How does chaos at the county level affect your school district?
Well, we were looking forward to getting the property tax revenues because those are the monies we use. You know, that fuels our budget. Most of our monies come not from state revenues, but from local revenues, which is property taxes.
Is there a chance those property taxes might be delayed because of this confusion over reassessment?
We've talked with our business leadership and the superintendent at the district, and we budgeted very effectively. We also maintain a very healthy fund balance. Mm-hmm. We have to do that because most of our revenues are built on local revenue. Therefore, we don't get our money starting in July for the most part. Our revenues are coming as property taxes are paid and collected. So the new year budget revenues will start to really flow in come December and January. Mm-hmm. So we have planned for that. I think we among all the other school district taxing jurisdictions, we knew that property tax assessments had been lagging and the valuations had been lagging since the recession. And so this is part of this process, though difficult, and we know that some families have challenges and we are deeply sympathetic. We also know that we haven't recovered since 2008.
Just to be clear, so is there a chance that money coming from the county, your property tax dollars, might be delayed, or some of them might be delayed, or do you know yet?
Some portion.
Manny, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, some portion may be because people are filing appeals right now.
Okay, okay. And that could impact budgets, but you have a reserve to deal with it, it sounds like. I'm also wondering, there appears to be a new attitude in town, Patty, towards slowing down property tax breaks for developers. There's a new feeling about that in town. The district, of course, has been concerned about this for years. It's cost the district a lot of money, these tax breaks. What do you make of the new attitude? Is this a good thing, I gather, for the district?
Well, I think we're really optimistic. We have, prior to the elections, the mayoral elections, the superintendent and his team met with those two candidates, the two mayoral candidates. They have subsequently talked with Mayor Quentin Lucas and several of the council members. We actually sent a letter outlining some of our interests in how do we begin the dialogue to start to talk across a broad spectrum of business and taxing jurisdictions and local government to say, what is a more fair and balanced approach to the use of tax incentives? So that's a communication that we actually just sent to every council member and the mayor this week.
Well, Councilman Lucas, who's now the mayor, seems to be squarely in your court here when it comes to nipping breaks for developers in the bud here a little bit. Let's turn to charter schools. A new charter collaboration has begun. The district has a new office solely for charter collaboration. What's the goal there, Marvia? What's going on there?
Yeah, the primary goal, from my understanding, is to improve the way that we share the resources. So we know things are tight and things have been going inefficiently. And so this council, this group, they'd be able to collaborate, share data, and work more effectively with the resources we have.
Patty, what's inefficient? What needs to be fixed?
Well, you know, Marvia mentioned the education landscape study that we have produced. We've actually shared that all around the state of Missouri. And as well with all the charter schools in Kansas City. And as she pointed out earlier, we have an overabundance of buildings and an overabundance of seats and not enough students. What that means is we're spending more money, both Kansas City Public Schools as a district and charter schools, we're spending more on operations than we are on instructional supports. So when we're have an abundance of facilities and an abundance of administration and all those things, then we have less money as an entire system for after school activities.
Your point is we have 22 charter schools in this city. That's a lot. And each of them has a principal and administrative staff, and all those dollars add up here.
So in Springfield, Missouri, they have about 27,000 students. They have five public high schools. In Kansas City, Missouri, or in Kansas City, Missouri Public Schools boundaries, we have 15 public high schools.
What needs to happen there?
Well, I think we need to have some conversation about where can we combine efforts and how do we...
With the charters you're talking about.
Yes. How do we... Because, Steve... in the last year, three Kansas City charter schools closed. One just closed in May, and two closed last summer prior before the start of school.
Mm-hmm.
Not only is that a loss for families, because then they're left without the school they loved, and they get separated from the families they've met and their children and the connections, but it's actually a loss of scarce public dollars.
How big of a problem is this, Manny, as you look at it?
Yeah, I mean, I came from a charter school system, so I have a unique insight into some of those challenges there. And everyone's 100% right. I mean, we're duplicating resources in many different ways here. And so as a student of education, I guess, currently, it's also to look at the lens of solutions here. Other charter school systems work in different cities, right? And their governance models are very different than what we have here. And so as we look at the equity process overall, I think we need to look towards our state to ask them, how do they foresee this working in the future? I don't think it behooves anyone, charter schools or public schools, to add more schools to the system now, right? Mm-hmm. So there are very quick fixes that we can look at.
Such as what? Give me an example.
Not allowing future charter schools to add into this metropolitan area, right? I mean, if we look just at that alone, we can start to get a grasp as to the quantity of seats we have and look to how we all can rise together. Everyone agrees that we want to just educate our children well. We all agree, whether it's a charter school, public school, parochial, we want to succeed together. The more schools we add to that system, the more we're diluting the ability for that to happen.
You know, given your perspective, Manny, have the charter schools improved the quality of Kansas City, Missouri public schools? Has the added competition made a difference?
Some, yes. Others, I think, as you see, if you're looking specifically at the data, the academic performance is not too different than what the school district is producing right now. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's important, as parents look at this, not to just see the shiny new buildings, but to also ask about the academic performance of these schools.
Yeah. You know, Marvia, school starts on Monday. What are you worried about overseeing your first full day of school? What goes through a board member's mind?
What's going through my mind kind of echoes back to something Patty mentioned earlier, which is that people some people may not feel it necessary to show up on the first day or show up on time. Or maybe they didn't work out some kinks on finishing their enrollment or getting their vaccinations or whatever. So I worry that people don't take it seriously, which is why I've been encouraging folks to start on time first day. That first day is so important.
Where do board members go on the first day of school? Do you go out to the bus stops? Do you go out to the schools? What do you do?
Well, we have a whole slate of schools to visit, so we all have our schedules. We'll be everywhere, like showing up, showing support, welcoming everyone back. So.
Okay, well, good luck on Monday. We'll be rooting for y'all. I want to thank our board members here. Patty Manser, the board chairwoman, Marvia Jones, the Sub-District 4 board member, and Manny Abarca is the Sub-District 3 board member. Thank you all for a good conversation. Good luck this year.
Thank you.
Stay in touch about accreditation, too. We want to hear about it.
Thank you.
When we come back, we're going to talk about Charlie Parker and what he means to this community 64 years after his passing. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, we spoke with two Latinas living and working in Kansas City now who originally are from El Paso. They shared their thoughts on the recent mass shooting there. It was a powerful conversation. You can hear it at kcur.org/up-to-date. Listeners of Up to Date who are not subscribed to our weekly newsletter are only getting part of the story. To get the full scoop from me and my team, go to kcur.org/Kraske and subscribe. It'll take you maybe 10 seconds. That's kcur.org/Kraske. You know, you just have to wonder what Charlie Parker would think about the fact that here it is, 64 years after his passing at age 34, that his old hometown is still remembering him with a series of events each summer. Charlie Parker revolutionized jazz, and he remains an emotional touchstone for players and fans alike. You can't help but wonder, though, how millennials regard him and his musical innovations. This is the subject of a panel featuring Bobby Watson next Thursday evening at 6 at the Nelson Atkins. This is part of the 2019 Parker commemoration here in town. There are a whole series of events in addition to this panel discussion. Just Google 2019 Charlie Parker Celebration, and you'll come across a full schedule of events presented by KC Jazz Alive. With us here to talk about Charlie Parker and the millennials are Chuck Haddix, who hosts the Fish Fry here on KCUR each weekend night. He's the curator of the Mars Sound Archives at UMKC and author of Bird, The Life and Music of Charlie Parker. Chuck, always a thrill to have you here. Welcome back.
Great to do a little radio with you, Steve.
Mitch Butler is also joining us today. He's the coordinator of jazz studies over at UMKC. Professor Butler, good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to have you with you. You bet.
Absolutely.
For the uninitiated, Mitch, let's put Charlie Parker on the map. He's one of our own here, obviously. Who was he? How did he change jazz?
Yeah, it's a great way to start this discussion, is to talk about the legacy of Charlie Parker, who he was, what he did. And, you know, simply put, Charlie Parker changed the language of the music. He changed the standard by which many of the young musicians at that time, and older musicians for that matter, would aspire to in terms of improvisation and how to play jazz when they stood up to take a solo.
Chuck,
or forming small groups.
Yeah. Yes. Chuck, you wrote the book. This was a man of thunderous talent, as Mitch just said, and monstrous demons. Tell us about him.
Well, you know, there's music before Charlie Parker and music after Charlie Parker.
Is it that dramatic?
Yeah, it's that dramatic. He's like Mozart in that way. He's a transitional figure in jazz, much like Ellington, also Louis Armstrong, and Ornette Coleman. He changed everything, and with his approach to improvising in compositions.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was also a cultural icon. I mean, he goes beyond just his music. He attracted a large following during his life,
mm-hmm.
and he influenced not only the musicians that followed, but he also influenced painters, writers, poets. You know, so many poets have sung his praises in verse. Basquiat did it. You know, devoted works to him. He saw his art as going across artistic boundaries.
What was it, Chuck, about Charlie Parker? What was inside of him that allowed him to become a revolutionary, in a sense, when it came to jazz? Where did that stuff come from?
I think it came from, well, he's a product of the late night jam sessions here in Kansas mm-hmm. City. In 1936, he was sitting in on a jam session at the Reno Club, and he faltered musically while playing Honeysuckle Rose. And Joe Jones threw a cymbal
across the room and booted him off the bandstand.
You know, that's stuff of legend, but it actually happened according to Gene Ramey. And he said, and Charlie said, I will never get caught short again at a jam session. And so he retreated to his mother's house, and the next summer he went to the Lake of the Ozarks, where he stayed on site, and he learned all the chord changes and all the inversions and all the tricks of the trade, and then he returned a musically changed man. He had actually pioneered bebop here in Kansas City. Claude Fiddler Williams said they called it crazy music.
Crazy music, yeah. Mitch, what do you think of it, his music today? How does it impact you even now?
Well, it impacts us because the language that I would learn as a musician, and everyone that I know comes directly from Charlie Parker. Hmm. As a trombonist, I studied the music of J.J. Johnson, the improvisational sure. style of J.J. Johnson, who was directly influenced by Charlie Parker. So everyone who came during, you know, his contemporaries and this what we call the second generation of modern jazz players like J.J. Johnson and Sonny Rollins and that group of folk who we're all influenced by, we all tried to learn those solos. And then eventually you have to get back to the source where you go back and transcribe Charlie Parker himself. Hmm. And so no matter, you know, sort of where you go musically in terms of your own compositions and your own bands that you form, you have been influenced by, you know, the total change in the style and the language of Charlie Parker. Just like Chuck said, it was music before and music after. People were blown away.
Mitch, as a player yourself, can you describe for me the degree of difficulty of playing the way Charlie Parker did?
Well, I get this question sometimes, and I sort of put it in two categories. There's the difficulty of the language itself, the veracity, the pace and tempo at which he played. Is certainly challenging. It's more chromatic. It's what we call more angular. That is, highs and lows seem to come in rapid succession. And then, of course, as a trombonist, it becomes even more difficult because
you got to move that slide, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So I speak about it in two ways. But yes, it can be a challenge, but it's also very satisfying. As a young musician, when you start to understand what's happening, when you start to develop your facility and your technique based on this way that Charlie spoke through the horn.
You know, Chuck Haddix, just to bring this conversation full circle, because earlier this week we did a show on the great Jay McShann, his new release that you wrote the liner notes for. It's just a stupendous album. Just love the album. But he was the one who discovered Charlie Parker, right? I mean, two local men here changing music.
That is correct. When Hootie McShann arrived in Kansas City in December 1936, he got a gig at the Monroe Inn over on Independence Avenue. And he got off early enough to where he could make the rounds because it was a neighborhood bar. So he's walking down 12th Street outside a club called the Barley Duke. And it has an outdoor sound system, and he hears Bird, and he'd never heard anything like that before, Bird soloing. Mm-hmm. And so he goes in and introduces himself, and Charlie said, and they meet, and they said, well, we hope we work with you in the future. And then he had a gig at Martin's on the Plaza, which mm-hmm. is Martin's 210 West 47th Street. And that's where Bird first joined the band, and he was only with him for a short while. But it really, you know, it was a band that broke down the color barrier on the Plaza. Huh. And Bird at that time is developing the harmonic language that would lead to bebop. But the thing about Jay McShann is he's very laid back. So he'd put up with Bird getting high and showing up high or not showing up at all.
Right.
He would tell him, go get it out of your system, goof, and then come back.
Yeah.
And then, of course, when he formed the big band, Charlie joined that, and they played at the Playmore Ballroom, and it was, I don't know if Charlie Parker would have ever made it out of town if it hadn't been for Jay McShann.
That's amazing. Yeah. Well, Mitch Butler, one of our guests today, will be moderate a panel at 6 p.m. on Thursday, next week Thursday, at the Nelson Atkins on Jazz, Millennials, and the Music and Legacy of Charlie Parker. It's free, and it'll be a good because Bobby Watson's on the panel, along with Eddie Moore and the great Tia Fuller. I want to listen to some more Charlie Parker music. We're talking a lot here. Let's listen to some more. This is maybe one of his best known compositions. It's Now's the Time. Talking about the great Charlie Parker here this morning as Kansas City gets up to gear up again for Charlie Parker celebration this month in Kansas City. Lots of information online. Just go to 2019 Charlie Parker Celebration and you'll come across a full list of events for things going on this month. You know, Mitch, I'm wondering, to what extent do your students at the UMKC Jazz Studies program, how much do they, you know, to what extent do they know who Charlie Parker is when they walk into the classroom for the first time?
Well, for the first time, it varies. There are kids that, grew up with parents who listen to jazz, and so they're well aware of who Charlie Parker is. And then there are kids that come in who have musical proficiency, but maybe are new to jazz or relatively new to jazz. And so the depth at which they know about Charlie Parker maybe not as much, but what happens once they come through the door is it becomes pretty apparent to them that he's a pretty important person. And usually what happens is through the practice of listening and study, they realize, wow, there's not a whole lot of people in the history of this music that have changed it so radically. And so they start to dive into the music, the language, the improvisational skill.
I was going to say, are they interested in him, or do you have to sell it pretty hard? Does he seem like an old guy to them? Or,
yeah, right.
I mean,
yeah, no, that's a great question. I'll just think about back to my days, as a young musician. What I thought jazz was, and it was pretty limited. And so for me personally, yeah, I had to be sold to go and check it out. But once I checked it out, it was, I didn't need to be sold anymore. and so it can, like I say, it varies just depending on, their exposure to, jazz from 1917, until today. So it just depends on what their experience is.
You know, Chuck, I can't help but notice that your book on Charlie Parker came out a few years ago, back in 2013. It's about to be translated in Japan, I understand. Big news for you. And there was a second book on Parker by Stanley Crouch that came out at almost exactly the same time. That suggests to me unusual interest in Charlie Parker even these days. That's pretty amazing.
Oh, yeah. And right now, Carl Wojdak is editing his book for a second publication on that, too. Mm-hmm. I work with Stanley. Stanley's book's very different than mine. He incorporated fictive elements into it, much like what Ross Russell did earlier on.
Mm-hmm.
Stanley and I actually get along very well. And we did a number of book signings together, including one here and also at the Jazz Showcase in Chicago.
Right.
But there's continuing interest in my my research continues into Charlie Parker. I'm always discovering new things about Charlie Parker.
What's one of the latest things you discovered about him that we didn't know?
I did an interview with a guy who was whose father was a big time drug dealer here in Kansas City. He was a pot dealer, and Charlie Parker would show up to his house when they were out when he was in town. And would hang out there, and he would show up with a reverend called the Reverend, I think it was Lavender. And this guy drove a big Cadillac and had this big gold cross around his neck. And he would chauffeur Charlie Parker around. And this guy told me some great stories about, he would show up and just, they would just party for days.
Wow.
And,
wow.
You know, I got into Charlie Parker kind of backwards because I was interested in Kansas City jazz. And when I was, coming up in the early 70s and getting interested in it, Jay McShann was still around, Step Buddy Anderson, Orville Minor, Piggy. All these cats were around, and I was really interested in Moton and Basie and all that. And they always had a story about Charlie Parker.
Mm-hmm.
Luke Manhamsa told me about seeing Charlie Parker walk through the neighborhood with his horn in a paper bag.
Is that right?
Yeah, and all these crazy stories about Bird.
You know, you work at UMKC, Chuck. What's your sense of the interest that younger people have in Charlie Parker, those who are musically inclined and maybe at the Jazz Studies Institute?
Well, we have a lot of students come in and listen to Charlie Parker in the Mars Sound Archives and also do their research in Labuddy Special Collections. We have the number of collections related to Charlie Parker, including Jay McShann's collection, Step Buddy Anderson's collection, including a manuscript that's never been published called Suffering Cats.
Huh.
And, they also come in to use, our electronic resources, like the Kansas City Star. And when I did my book on Kansas City jazz for Oxford Press, I made copies of all the music references in the Kansas City Call from 1919 to 1943 and selected runs of the Journal Post. And also I have a vertical clipping file. And so students come in and use my research, raw research, and studying not only Charlie Parker, but, I was recently contacted by the great-grandson of George E. Lee. Mm-hmm. He didn't know anything about George E. Lee.
Huh.
And he's reading my book, and then he'll come to Kansas City and use my resources. So we have the resources that the young people can use and learn more about Charlie Parker and other Kansas City jazz artists, as well as jazz artists internationally.
And Mitch, I'm wondering to what extent millennials these days are connecting with jazz. What's your sense as you get around town and work with your students there?
Well, that's what this panel discussion on the 15th is all about,
right?
Is to sort of delve into that topic a little bit more. And my sense is, and not just in Kansas City, but around the country, and I've been fortunate enough to live in a lot of different places.
Mm-hmm.
And so my sense is that there is some sort of view. I try not to think about it in terms of when I was in school and so forth, but hey, I'm starting to get a few years, so not too many, but yeah. It's getting there. And so you can't help but reflect. And when I was in school, didn't seem too far back, but now that's been 25 years. And so it's getting on in time. And so my sense is there is some perspective that, like you asked before, Steve, older guy, been gone for a long time. But even with that, I still hear them attempting things that would not be spoken in musically speaking,
right?
Would not be improvised without that language of Charlie Parker.
Yeah.
So it becomes this indelible thing. And so, my sense is that, it's moving on in time, and it seems a bit of a long time ago, but once you kind of talk to them and expose them to what is the music of Charlie Parker, they kind of go back and check it out. I do want to add this. It doesn't take away from their own creativity. It doesn't take away from their being in touch with current music, the music that's on the radio, the music that they want to create that is influenced by everything from country, modern country to modern hip hop, R&B and gospel. So it doesn't take away from that at all. But it we're going to sort of explore how these two things merge, that legacy, that musical legacy, and what is today.
Yeah, Chuck.
Well, there's always that. There's a tradition in Kansas City, and Parker was part of that tradition, where older musicians passed the tradition on to younger musicians.
Yes.
And that still happens today, you know, informally in jam sessions, formally at the Conservatory of Music. And there's always been a concern in jazz circles that, are we reaching a young audience? This is an old dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And I think today we're being effective with that, because you go down to the Green Lady Lounge on a Friday and Saturday night, it's packed with millennials.
That's right. That's right.
And they're digging jazz.
Yeah, Mitch, I can't help but wonder, Charlie Parker learned the music on the streets of Kansas City on 12th Street, 18th and Vine. What's the necessity for jazz education today?
That's a great question, but one that has been asked a lot, and I usually put it a couple of ways. One, you know, the music that we hear when we turn on the radio today.
I've got about 30 seconds, just so you know.
Okay, yeah. It's interesting, and it's popular, but it is not. Of the sort of musical fabric of the music from that day.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important to have a laboratory in which the students can really dive into the feeling and the language of the music that will sort of carry them in their careers.
Again, Mitch Butler will moderate a panel at 6 next Thursday evening at the Nelson Atkins on Jazz, Millennials, and the Music and Legacy of Charlie Parker. It'll feature Bobby Watson. I want to thank Mitch Butler from Jazz Studies at UMKC, Chuck Haddix, host of The Fish Fry here at KCUR. He's the author of Bird, The Life and Music of Charlie Parker. Thank you both very much. Sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve and Chuck.
Thank you, Steve.
Next week on the show, a look at what it takes to grow marijuana in Missouri legally. You can find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. KCUR is on Facebook. And go to kcur.org/Kraske to sign up for our weekly newsletter. We had help this week from Linda Scherer, Maria Carter, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Emily Aiken, who's enjoying her last day with us following a stupendous internship with Up to Date. We all thank Emily for her help and wish her the best of luck in her final semester over at Mizzou. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are Up to Date.